Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Carl Carlson.
And this is Fred Schenkberg. Hey, Carl, what's happening today? A bright, sunny Friday morning here where I am.
Beautiful day in Florida.
Hey, good for you. That won't last. You know that. So
I know. When we're done with the podcasting, I'll have to get outside.
There you go. Well, is that a habit that you have? Is, you know, when it's nice, go for a walk or kayak or bike ride or something like that?
I guess you could call it a habit. And, you know, it's funny how some of us work in the direction of our habits. And that brings up a topic I wanted to ask you about.
All right.
I've been thinking about something, Fred, which is how often people, including myself, for years, would recommend tools and explore tools and reliability based on habit. Things that we're experienced with, things that we're comfortable with, maybe comfort zone is even a better way to say it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very comfortable recommending a reliability block diagram, and I don't think I've ever recommended a fault tree analysis.
Well, there you go.
For example.
And it would be a completely different way to look at it, is to say, what does the program need versus what are we comfortable recommending?
Well, we ran into that dilemma of in writing the book. It's in order to focus on the gaps and what does the organization need? What does the decision makers need? What could create this information that's required to make a decision? If the only things you know about are FMEAs and block diagrams and accelerated testing, you have a very limited palette to choose from. And so I think the missing part there is the awareness of what is available. What are all the tools? And I think we ended up drafting out a 200-page chapter, and we decided that's a little bit too much.
Yes. Yeah. Chapter and verse of all reliability tools.
And we know from experience that most reliability engineers don't go to school first. They get tapped on the shoulder and said, hey, you're the reliability person. Now make it happen. And it's today I have this problem. I got to come up with an accelerated life test. And I'm thinking my own personal experience. And all right, well, let me go learn about accelerated life tests. And it wasn't long before I was known as a person that did those kinds of tests, could set them up and design them and analyze them. And that became a depth for me. And it wasn't until I started looking around and go, oh, there's other things I can do. There's the cost of, you know, the variability on the production line is causing problems in the field. Let me go learn control charts and do stuff like that. But it was, like you mentioned, it was my go-to set of tools is the first couple I learned because that's what I knew. And it wasn't until writing about different tools and writing different articles for people preparing for the CRE exam, for example, that I really started to delve into all these other methods that are out there. And then I found that as I gained awareness of them, then I was much more comfortable recommending them and using them and with clients.
Well, that's interesting, Fred, because I was looking at like the notes I wrote down while we just started talking. I wrote two words down. Why gaps?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Now, you and I totally independently worked on our reliability consulting careers and came up with very similar processes. I remember that first time we talked about the subject mm-hmm. a long, long time ago. And it's just fascinating that we ended up with this. We had a very similar approach, which is, you need to understand gaps. You have to start with a vision, where are you headed? But then right away, you got to know what the gaps are. And yet, no matter how often we teach this subject, many people, not everybody, but many people just settle into their comfort zone and select tools based on what they're most comfortable with and most experienced with. And so I wrote down the word, why are gaps needed? So maybe we need to explain better why gaps are needed, And yet you offered something here, which I hadn't thought of, which is you probably won't even go in the direction of gaps if you don't understand that there's an array of tools available to select from.
Yeah, if you look at the process, and I only know three methods, right? I only really ever apply three methods. There's no point in understanding what the needs are because I'm just going to do these three things.
Regardless.
And in some cases, FMEA is a pretty versatile tool and modeling is a pretty versatile tool. So you can get a lot of traction on that. It's just that when, let's say your program manager or your project manager says, but I really need to know the cost trade-off of this, this, and this. And FMEA and block diagrams really are a stretch to make that work. You got to use some other types of methods to sort out the cost of unreliability, for example, or dive deep into a failure analysis and its ramifications for the product's performance. It's not the total explanation yet. I think there's another piece to this is that as the program, any project I've ever been involved with, they get ramped up, they start assigning a bunch of people to the program and it's, let's get the requirements document nailed down, let's do this. And the engineers are itching to start designing and, let's get this moving. And what's your plan? And by the way, you have 87 other tasks to do this week. And so you just grab the plan from the last program and pull it over and take the cover off, put a new cover on it and go, this worked last time, it'll work again, kind of thought. And it's expedient. It saves you time. You don't have to go talk to a bunch of people. All the people that you need to talk to are busy doing their day job and extra. And so there's a handful of barriers there until it's, oh, this is important. I need to take care of this. I need to talk to Carl and understand what is it I need and assess that against what we're capable of doing, where those gaps are. And I think there's some barriers, headwinds for us to get this through as a nominal or normal process for people to take.
You use the word expedient, and I agree, but I also have a four-letter word that came to mind, lazy. I think it's intellectually lazy to just copy the previous program. And I know people that have done it and they're not lazy people. Mm-mm. They've just got into that habit of, and it's also what's acceptable.
Yep.
Like their management accepts it.
Well, like I said, that management team is spinning up a new development program and they're beyond busy. There's a lot on their plate. And so check, got a reliability plan. All right, move on. And didn't even read it.
A couple stories come to mind. And then maybe we can explore a little more on why gaps are essential into developing a good reliability program.
Mm-hmm.
But one story is I hired a really, really good reliability engineer. Actually, he was a tremendous design engineer. And then... Taught him reliability. And this person became enamored with HALT. And I can see that. What a fantastic tool HALT is,
mm-hmm,
to get quickly at how things fail. And so it can be inserted as part of product development, and you can discover the mechanisms of failure very quickly, and you can eradicate them. And you have to make certain assumptions and that type of thing. A wonderful tool. See, his reliability practice became, until I worked with him a little more, became go out into the design world, the design area, and find HALT projects and help them execute.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, so what's wrong with that? Well, what's wrong with that is HALT may or may not be the right tool for a given reliability project. And so that's what's potentially wrong with it. It could be the wrong tool.
Right.
And what's right with it is he's experienced, he knows it well, he can sell it, that kind of thing. So I think the downside is significant when you just automatically do an FMEA or automatically do halt or automatically do reliability profiles, which whatever you select because you're comfortable with it, or automatically do a copy paste of the previous program. There's significant downside to that. And I kind of want to think about with you what that downside is, so maybe people will see it. What do you think would be the problem with that?
Well, the easiest one is that, and I know you've done this too, is you go, so why are you doing this? Why are you running this test? And sometimes it's a test that the customer required. Okay, well, what can we learn from that? Or it's a regulatory requirement. All right, I doubt there's anything we can learn from this, but you know, we have to do it. It's a condition of business. But you're doing this test over here that's flexing this cable a whole bunch of times. And why are you doing that? And the answers range from, well, we always test the cables before we put them in our products. Okay, have you ever had a problem with that? No. Is it a field issue? No. Does anybody actually need the results of this to make a decision? Are you going to use this cable design or not? No. Okay, well, let me ask this again. Why are you doing this? And if it's, well, we always do it, I usually then drill down pretty hard and say, hey, stop it. You know, you need to think this through. If I get an answer of, well, it's a brand new vendor, we're trying a new polymer and a stress relief function on it, we want to make sure that it works better than what we have now. Okay, tell me about the test. And if it's a comparison test and it's replicating the stresses and mechanisms they want, then you're in great shape. But if the first answer is, oh, we always do this, then my hackles go up. You know,
absolutely. Totally. So now if they're doing something, say you're not on the scene to ask the why question, and they're going about doing something because they've always done it, what's the downside to that?
Well, obvious one is there's a resource, time, energy, samples, all of that is just wasted because it's going to, you know, even a simple test nowadays, it costs you $10,000 and some of them will cost you quite a bit more with chambers and special rigs and cost of prototypes and so on. It can add up pretty quick. Then you add on the time it takes for engineers and technicians and so on to do it. And they really could be doing something else. Those resources really could be adding value with just a little bit of thought. And so I think it's a wasted resource. One.
That's a good one. I agree completely that we don't want to waste resources. Another one comes to mind, which is the real issues go unaddressed.
Yeah, we're diverting away from what we should be focusing on. The other part is it provides a false confidence that you're doing reliability when you're actually not doing much of anything.
Wonderful. It's what's the phrase that you hear from time to time? But you basically, it's performance. It's almost like entertainment.
That's right. We do these so the tourists are ooh and ah when they walk through our lab.
Yeah.
You know, okay. I'm thinking of Apple. That doesn't happen very often.
No.
Nobody walks around the lab without everything covered in black tarps and stuff. It's fabric. But yeah.
But you can present at a management meeting the status of this tool that's not needed, and don't really realize it's not needed, and they'll kind of nod their heads and think you're doing a good job.
Yeah.
It's harder to ask why, because you might offend people. You might actually make them think.
Well, that's painful. Yeah, you know.
It's painful to think. So I'm not being totally sarcastic. It actually is, it's difficult. You'd have to practice.
Yeah.
Fronting people and saying, why are you doing this?
I mean, part of it was ingrained in me pretty early on. I was the safety officer for the factory I was first started working in when I got out of the military. And the junior engineer was assigned the safety officer. And so I was like, this doesn't make much sense, guys.
No.
And so I'm sitting down with the general manager and his staff, and there's all kinds of stories that come out of it. But one of the general managers that I got to work with, it was, show me the data. it was, he had like three or four phrases that made you have to do your homework. He may not have been the expert in process control, but he said, show me the data. Why is this relevant? What's the difference it's going to make? And he would say stuff like that. And so you knew that if you're presenting anything to him, you had to be able to answer those questions. And it just became a filter for him to go, are you doing something useful?
And we should ask that question of ourselves. Like, it shouldn't take, that's a great manager, leader, mm-hmm. to ask those questions. But if you want to be a good reliability engineer, we should ask those questions of ourselves. Why am I doing this? What am I getting out of it? Where's the product going to be used? And then if there isn't a good answer to that, then you should be doing something else.
Yeah. And that goes into that gap analysis. Let's go figure out who needs what information. I think that's the summarizes that entire chapter in the book in one short sentence. Who needs what information by when? And what's important, right? What's the $1 million decision versus the $10 decision? Let's do a guideline or a recommended practice kind of book or cheat sheet for the $10 decisions. And let's focus on how do we actually get the right information so we make the right decision. And that is the thinking part. Is there's two parts to this, though, that I see as barriers. Is one, we mentioned earlier, is just that we don't have time and nobody else has time. So that you have to get over that, no, this is important. This is when we make a difference. And then the second part is engineers tend not to like going over to ask somebody questions. We're not natural interviewers. We're not,
yeah.
You know, we tend to be, and this is a gross generalization, but we tend to be more introverted. Give me a problem to solve, I'll go over here and solve it.
Right. I won't offend anybody.
Right. And so asking tough questions of, you know, what keeps you up at night, or what we have these three things are new. Are they well versed? Do we know what we're doing with those, or do we need to get more information? It's probing into the unknowns, the areas where people are like, you know, I'm not sure about that, which is a barrier for most people to admit.
So my summary of why gaps is, and it's similar to yours, but a little bit different, came to mind, which is, mm-hmm. let's say you and I are going on a hiking trip. We're going up a mountain, mm-hmm. maybe not an easy climb. Well, you could go about just, okay, it's the morning of the hike. Let's go.
Yep.
Or, and I've made this mistake even within the last year. Or you could actually do a little bit of research on what the hike is. How long is it? How steep is it? Mm-hmm. What kind of water are we going to need? Do we have the right tools? Oh, we don't. We don't have carabiners, but we're going to need to use them. Mm-hmm. That would be what I would call a gap analysis. So the vision is, where are we going? How long is it? What time period are we want to be there by? You know, basically, mm-hmm. where are you headed? But the gap is, what are we missing that we need in order to accomplish that objective?
Yeah, if you don't have a rope in a harness and it's a vertical climb, you're taking a hell of a risk, to extend your metaphor a little longer, right?
Yeah, it's a hell of a risk. You know, I'll share the story with you. This is, I won't go into the whole detail, but last year we were up in Maine. I went to hike with one of our grandkids and one of our children and my wife and I, and I did not research the hike very well. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was taking a little walk up a hill.
Right. It's Maine. It's flat, right?
Yeah. It was a serious hike. And I didn't bring enough water. So I turned back after a while. I said, I'm going to get down, because I just didn't bring enough water. Mm-hmm. And some of the others did the same thing. And a couple of people went on. But the point is that it's really important to know your gaps before you go about, and selecting the tool would be like selecting you might, in a hike, you might need a map. You might need, maybe you're going to have a GPS. That's a tool. et cetera, et cetera. And reliability, I never any longer, I used to all the time, but I never, when I'm working with a company, I never say, okay, let's automatically do this, use this tool.
Right.
Always talk with people and understand where they're headed, what they want to achieve, and then see what the gaps are, and then select the tools to help them make the decisions and close the gaps. It's now inherent in me, but I don't think it's inherent in everyone. And that's why I wanted to spend a minute and kind of self-reflect on why it's so important.
Well, we wrestled with this for a while. We did the gap analysis, and then you and I very naturally with clients would say, all right, I interviewed you all. I see these as strengths and weaknesses. Here's the plan. We would say, these are things we need to do in order to move this project forward. And it took us a lot of discussion to figure out, how did we do that? You know, it was the stepping back and going, how did we know they needed this and not that? And we started breaking that down and thinking it through. And I think that it was once we said, oh, if you move it to focus on decisions, that you're providing these tools and methods all do something. They almost always provide information. It'll last 10 years or it won't. It'll be more stable than that vendor. This is, you know, more stable, more consistent than that process and so on. But that's not the end of the story. That's just information. It's not that we go do these things and we create a nice report. And if it's, we have to feed that to part of the program, to an engineer or a manager or somebody to make a decision. And once that became clear, at least for me, then it said, ah, what you and I would do innately is go, oh, given the circumstances, this is holding you back. You need this information at this time. You need to understand if this is going to work, you know, 5 years or not. And this, and then we wouldn't articulate that. At least I didn't. And I'd say, all right, you need to do this, 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 and this. And right. And so breaking it down really made it, the gap analysis is a process to understand the foundational pieces, the map or the environment of that particular organization project at that time. And then where are the barriers? Where are the deficits? Where are the things that will hold you back? And then you pick the tools.
Right, right. And so critical. So the takeaway from this is don't just select tools based on what you're comfortable with, what you're experienced with, what the management is expecting. Always, if you have a new program, understand what the vision is and what the gaps are before you select those tools. And I'll put in the show notes some resources on gap analysis. So it isn't just a generality. In other words, I'll put a link to some of the articles that exist and so that people understand what that is. But I really encourage people to do that. If you're a listener, and I'd love to know how you select tools. What do you actually do how do you go about it?
Yeah, what's your process?
Let us know that.
Yeah, and you can do that over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. There's a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Carl and I and the other hosts are available through LinkedIn and our About pages. There's lots of ways for you to get in touch with us. And Carl and I wrestled with this, and we kind of backed into what we think is the process we use. And I think it's pretty accurate for what we do. But what do? How do you decide to run this test versus that test or do this process or that process or do FMEA or HALT or both or none? The one thing we didn't talk about, Carl, is the impact of all the constraints that impact our choice of tools too. So there might be a perfect method to use. That might be a topic for a whole nother discussion.
Oh, it is. It is. You're so right. And it's in our book, and we would talk about it. But the constraints are really important because you could have financial constraints. You might need extra equipment. There's like
timelines. We could go on and on about that.
I surface that as part of gap analysis.
It is. It's part of it is that you got to understand the environment that is, we're trying to create a reliable product. And what's the path? Using that hiking analogy again.
Very good. What path are we going to take? Are we going to go straight to the top, or are we going to go around the hill a little bit?
Well, I just get a helicopter these days. This walking's overrated.
Well, we'd love to hear from you. So please, please get in touch with us.
Yep. Yeah, we definitely want to hear from you. So thanks much, Carl, for bringing this one up. I appreciate it.
All right, Fred. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.